We'll introduce Jonathan Walton to you guys. He's a distinguished faculty member here at MSU. He's also my neighbor and dear friend. So I thought of him immediately when we began to talk about wanting to do something about bioenergy or biofuels, because I really don't know anything about it, but I know that he's the assistant director of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center here at MSU. His vita just goes on and on and on, so I hardly know. He has brought in immense grant proposals to the university, but you know, he's just my neighbor. So.
Aw, shucks.
Shucks, yes. There you Thank go. You. So, with that, go to it.
All right. So I'm on, right? Okay, yeah. Great. It's a small crowd, so feel free to interrupt at any point if you want some clarification. So I haven't talked to a group like this before, so it's a little uncertain about what exactly you're going to be more interested in or less interested in. What I'm going to do is I'm going to describe what the GLBRC is and its impact on the campus. I'm going to talk about the bigger energy question, about you know why we came into being, why the citizens of this great country decided that they should invest a lot of money in bioenergy research. And I'm going to talk about the pros and cons of bioenergy and biofuels in general, and try to give you a flavor, at least, for all of the different directions in which it could be going, some of which are clearly preferable to others. And then finally, I'm going to say a few words about my own specific research, again, to give you a flavor for the kinds of things we're doing and why. I realize you're not a technical audience, so obviously it's not... I'll try not to use too much jargon or shorthand, and feel free to interrupt if I'm leaving out some gap, if I make a gap in there, some critical piece of information. Well, this is sort of the GLBRC, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. This is what we're setting out to do. Sustainable technology. Sustainable means good for the environment, economically sustainable. Technologies for second-generation biofuels, first generation being to most people cornstarch converting into ethanol, an ongoing, active, profitable industrial concern process, but second generation means going beyond cornstarch ethanol or sugarcane ethanol into second generations. It is not a reality yet. The sobering fact is by now we're supposed to be making, I think it is, 250 million gallons of second generation ethanol by now in the country. Or that's the goal for next year. That was the goal set about 5 years ago. Well, that was hopelessly optimistic. I think we're on track to make about 10 million gallons. And when you look at who's making that, it's some very high-risk pilot plants that people are, well, they're investing in it, but people are skeptical that they're actually going to make a profit. But, of course, they're sometimes with venture capital and heavy investment, they hope to be positioned in the right spot. But right now we're way behind where people thought we might be 5 years ago. I'll try to give you some flavor for the problems, the technological problems. Okay, so what is the GLBRC? Well, about 5 years ago, the Department of Energy had a big think tank, a big meeting, and they decided to establish three of these bioenergy research centers. We're one of them. They're each funded at $25 million over 5 years. So we're getting, our center is getting $125 million and the other two centers also. So ours is the only one that's academic. The other two are sited at national laboratories the Department of Energy runs, things like Oak Ridge and Los Alamos and Lawrence Berkeley Lab, Pacific Northwest Lab. These are big things contracted to the Department of Energy. We're the only academic one. The lead institution is UW-Madison, but we're getting about half the money for the research. They do a lot of the administrative overhead, for which we don't envy them, but we're getting about half the money. So about $10 million a year is coming into to MSU as a result of the GLBRC. We have minor partners at Illinois State, Iowa, and Cornell. We do work with the national labs to some extent, Pacific Northwest and Oak Ridge. The Joint Genome Institute is funded by Department of Energy, and all they do there is DNA sequencing. It's phenomenal, and even the biologists who are involved in DNA sequencing now are stunned at the capacity and our ability to sequence DNA. They have hundreds of machines here that run around the clock, do nothing but DNA sequencing, and the technology makes quantum leaps every few years. So what, even 10 years ago, to sequence a gene was a big effort, but now we can sequence whole genomes in a matter of weeks. And we have a direct pipeline into this Joint Genome Institute. I think they say 10% of their capacity is set aside for the centers. So colleagues of mine have sent them things like 50 bacteria, and they can sequence all of these things incredibly fast. In fact, we're totally overwhelmed by the amount of DNA sequence information coming in much faster than anybody can process it. We also have an industry partner, a small company in Madison that does some contract work for us. So just at MSU, it's a pretty big operation. There are about 30 faculty involved, encompassing 10 departments and 4 colleges. And these departments range from things like ag economics to do modeling of agronomic systems, chemical engineering to develop better chemical pretreatments and for supposed to keep our eye on the ball in regards to scale up, because right now we work at the bench scale, but someday, of course, our technologies have to translate into millions of tons and millions of gallons. Crop and soil sciences for agronomic issues, forestry, we're making transgenic poplar trees that might make a better biomass crop. Kellogg Biological Station is heavily involved, and MBI. So we're really spread all over, and it's hard to keep track, actually, and understand what all of our colleagues are doing. Well, this is the overall structure of it. Tim Donahue is a UW professor. He's the overall director, but Ken Keekster here at Michigan State is the scientific director, actually managing director isn't actually correct. It should be scientific director. He's supposed to be in charge of the scientific portfolio. And we're organized into these thrust areas, one for improving plant biomass, and John Ralph is at Wisconsin, but Bruce Dale is here at MSU in the chemical engineering department. Processing means the pretreatments and the enzyme digestions. Converting, once we get the sugars out of the plants, we have to ferment them somehow, feed them to microbes typically to make alcohols or even other things, and he's at UW. But Phil Robertson is at KBS. He's an ecologist, and he's in charge of the sustainability thrust. I'm up here as the associate director. Basically, that means that I run this. I oversee our MSU staff of 4 people, and I sign the travel authorizations. That seems to be my main function in this whole thing. But I'll tell you about my actual research. Okay, so what's the background on all of this? Some of this will be familiar to anybody who's read the newspapers, and there's a lot of controversy, and you can have a lot of discussion about every single point I'm going to make here. Well, new sources of petroleum are shrinking. Demand in the U.S. remains strong. Of course, it goes up and down with the economic situation. Energy demand goes down during a recession and up in boom times. But India and China are growing, and they all want to buy cars, right? Everybody in China and India wants to own a car, just like in the United States back in the 20s and 30s. That means the demand for petroleum is going to go up a lot. On the other hand, it's also important that we use energy for including liquid transportation fuels for lots of other things in our lives. And people often forget that even growing food the way we do it today is very energy intensive. You need fuel for the tractors. Fertilizer is made from natural gas in large part, transporting the food around. Nowadays, I'm all for eating local. On the other hand, I'm very grateful for getting grapes in January shipped up from South America. We wouldn't be able to do that except that we have cheap fuels to transport the jets and things. Even packaging, of course, requires a lot of energy. And finally, probably the big bear in the room, is that the right expression? Dinosaur in the room?
Gorilla.
Gorilla, yes, in the room, is the fact that climate change is real and is staring us in the face. People keep trying to act like ostriches, right? There's another animal metaphor. Like ostriches, put our head in the sand and pretend that climate change isn't real, or if it's real, there's nothing we can do about it, and therefore we should just continue business as usual. We'll see what's happening. The winds of, you know, a couple of years ago, people were pretty convinced, but the climate change or cap and trade bill died I guess it was in the Senate, or was it the House? Anyway, it died, right? And it looks like in light of the recent election, it's not going to come back anytime soon. But something eventually probably will wake people up, right? When the Greenland ice sheet slips into the ocean or in the shoreline in Florida rises 2 feet or something like that, then people are probably going to wake up. And that's going to change the whole scenario. We're not going to be able to continue business as usual. However, so what we're trying to do is we're trying to make fuel from lignocellulosic material, which means basically wood, plant material. This table, for example, is all made out of lignocellulose, agricultural residues, municipal waste, newspapers, et cetera. But we have to be realistic and that cellulosic ethanol can't be the whole answer to the question. We can make about an estimated 1 billion tons of biomass. That would be crop residues and other things per year. And that could only supply, at most, about 60 billion gallons of liquid fuel, which would be about 30% of our needs. We're currently importing about 60% of our petroleum. So we're going to need a lot of different approaches. And we try to keep that foremost in our minds, that there isn't going to be an easy technological fix, no matter how successful we are in research. I put this slide in here to emphasize the point that, in fact, we don't really have an energy problem, an energy shortage problem. We have a shortage of liquid transportation fuels. So people often talk about energy crisis. Well, simply on energy terms, we have lots of energy in this country. We have lots and lots of coal. It could last us a long, long time. And coal is very cheap, and it's easy to burn. All you have to do is dig it out of the ground and stick it in a power plant. But this slide, which I borrowed from Bruce Dale, illustrates the fact that not all energy is equal, right? Some energy sources are much more desirable than others. Electricity can be used for so many great things, right? And that's one reason it's so expensive. Coal has got more limited use. You can burn it in power plants, but you can't run a car on coal. Natural gas, you can't really run a car on natural gas. You know, I don't know if that's necessarily true. I don't know why we, some countries they do actually run their cars more on gas or propane at least, but we don't in this country. Electric cars, I'll say a bit more about them later, you could in fact burn coal or agricultural residues for that matter to make electricity to run cars. But the current situation is we're running all of our transportation on liquid fuels derived from petroleum. Okay. So, I mean, this price is probably hopelessly out of date. Actually, it's when I first made it, or when Bruce first made it, it was accurate. Now it's accurate again. It's about $80 a barrel, right? It went up to 150 for a while. It's now back down to 80. But most predictions are that in 5 or 10 years, the price will be going up and perhaps never come down again. I want to emphasize, and this is all I'm going to say about it because it's not my area, is Area 4, our sustainability thrust. It ties into the technical areas of Area 1, that is better biomass plants, and Areas 2 and 3 about producing fuels or producing ethanol and the microbes for fermentation. But the Area 4, we're the only center, the only one of the three centers that has a really strong sustainability program. The others are much more technical, technological. So we're very proud of the fact that we have this. It makes us unique. And Phil Robertson is doing an incredible job of putting together an incredible team of everyone from agricultural economists to agricultural economists to agronomists, entomologists, to ecologists of all kinds, looking at the big picture of what it would involve, and particularly how can we nudge it in the right direction such that when we do, or if we do, get to the point where we have a biofuel economy, that it will be done right. I mean, there are regional and national impacts. What crop you're going to grow, it's going to depend where you are in the country, probably. How is it going to influence farmers' incomes? Where are you going to put these plants? What are the water use issues? There are a lot of issues, right? And it depends a lot on what plant you might grow. So enough said. It encompasses the entire world, all ecosystems, this Area 4, and we think that that's a really important part of it. You can imagine developing a technology that won't be any better than where we are now, but we hope to do it right. Some more words about the transportation fuel problem. You know, why is the Department of Energy, why are we spending all this money on research? Well, the price of gas is just one part of it. That's probably what consumers see first when they go down the street and look at the price of gas. So the economics is really important, and petroleum is expensive. The problem really is that it's still too cheap, so that other alternative sources can't compete with it. Petroleum is still remarkably inexpensive, and of course there's a huge infrastructure, right, set up for getting it out of the ground, for transporting it, for refining it, and delivering it finally to retail gas stations. We're sending a lot of money overseas, right, to pay for that 60% that we have to import. what this slide illustrates is several different perspectives on the bioenergy or energy problem in general. And I've noticed that when you talk to different people respond more or less strongly to these different issues. And everyone's got their priority about what they consider overwhelming. So national security, for example. The fact that we import so much means that we're just plain vulnerable. Our economy is vulnerable to a cutoff. It could be due to natural disasters or politics. And a shutdown in the supply of gasoline is extremely disruptive. People sometimes complain about subsidies for ethanol and farmers in general. The counterargument to that is, directly or indirectly, we actually subsidize petroleum to a very large extent. Now, when you think about all of the money we spend on defending the Persian Gulf, how much Saudi Arabia depends on us for its independence, you think of the Kuwait War. Iraq War is a little more controversial, but Kuwait was clearly, I think, from the point it had involved petroleum to a large extent. Then, of course, there's the environment. I mean, if global warming is real, then we're going to have to find ways of making energy that don't impose such a burden on the global climate and the global ecology. Not to mention, you know, other problems with petroleum, oil spills, air pollution, water consumption is an issue no matter how you make your energy. So coal gasification, for example, one of its main problems is it uses huge amounts of water. Petroleum refining uses water, but so does making ethanol. When I went to visit a local ethanol plant, the main thing on the mind of the manager was the fact that he was under pressure from the local people because they claimed that their wells were going dry because of the amount of water he was using. Water consumption could be. I'm not going to dwell on these points. This is a slide from Bruce Dale. I'll get to the bottom line. Biofuels ends up impacting a lot of different things, right? And it's not just the United States, but this biofuel impact could positively or negatively impact a lot of other economies in a lot of different ways. People are lining up for and against biofuels. Farmers in general are enthusiastic about it. In Iowa and Nebraska, they like a nice solid support, solid price for their corn. And this includes corn starch ethanol. About a third, I think, of the corn in Iowa now is going into ethanol. So farmers want new markets. And when you talk about ethanol subsidies, you're talking a lot about the political clout of farmers. National defense. The military is very concerned about our vulnerability to cut off of petroleum, and they're funding research, including here at Michigan State, on alternative fuels. The Air Force wants to know, can they run their jets on biodiesel? Maybe they're not thinking about a complete switchover, but there's this insurance factor. If our supply of petroleum were to get cut off in one way or another, that we would have at least some alternatives, homegrown alternatives. This is a quote from an executive at Marathon who said, the bottom line is we don't care. We just want stuff to put in our pumps to sell. We're a retail operation. They just want something that they can sell. And they love ethanol, because it's pretty compatible with existing infrastructure. Not totally, but pretty compatible, both with automobile engines and also pumping stations. And so they would be just as happy selling ethanol as gasoline. Environmentalists, it cuts both ways, right? Biofuels do. And clearly some biofuel strategies are much better than others. Bad ones include corn ethanol, corn starch ethanol, because it takes a lot of energy to grow that corn. You don't get, it's about break even in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. Oil trees that grow in the tropics produce incredible quantities of oil that could be converted into biodiesel fuel. However, to grow those oil palm plantations, you have to cut down a lot of tropical rainforest. A few years ago, Europe passed a mandate that something like 10% of their fuels had to be biofuels. But the problem is that people immediately went to palm oil. So, in fact, environmentally, it was probably worse than petroleum. So, tremendous production, but at major environmental cost. Greenhouse gases. Well, there's been a lot of studies, and they go back and forth about whether there's a net gain or loss of greenhouse gases and all these different technologies. most people conclude that lignocellulosic ethanol could be greenhouse gas positive. That is to say, it could lead to a reduction in CO2 emissions compared to hydrocarbons. Changes in land use. This has been an incredibly controversial topic. So the topic of indirect land use. If you start converting farms in some area to biofuel use, you put pressure on surrounding areas to grow food. Can you bring marginal lands back into production and grow biofuels there? But on the other hand, if a farmer can make more profit growing biofuel crops than food crops, we allow farmers to make their own decisions about what they want to grow. So the indirect land use issue has been very controversial. Well, that gets us to ethanol. The main focus of the GLBRC has been on trying to make ethanol from lignocellulose. We do work on a lot of other different things, but this is our main focus. Ethanol from cornstarch is a current reality. People, we know how to make factories. It's an old technology, right, of taking starch from potatoes or wheat and making alcohol out of it. Lignocellulosic biomass is something that we have a lot of, everything from trees to agricultural crop debris. Some people are very keen on cyanobacteria and algae. These are also called blue-green algae. I'm not very optimistic about algae, but there are a lot of people working on it, a lot of startup companies devoted to making things from algae. One of the advantages of ethanol, but other related alcohols as well, is they could be used in cars and existing infrastructure with minor changes. So you can buy a flex fuel vehicle that will run on E85, that is 85% ethanol, and the cost of conversion is, I'm told, only a couple of $100s. Brazil has done this very successfully. They mandated flex fuel vehicles, and so people can decide, actually, day to day, whether they prefer to use gasoline or ethanol, depending on the day's price. And that flexibility has turned out to be very successful. Biodiesel is a potentially great fuel. It could be made very readily from any plant oil. A couple of simple chemical steps converted to stuff you can put right into your car. Straight biodiesel doesn't work very well at cold temperatures, but you can blend it and other things like that. The main problem with it is that the yields you get per acre of oils, things like soybeans anyway and canola, are too low. Palm oil in the tropics has tremendously better yields, but then there are the environmental problems of clear-cutting tropical areas to make to grow plantations. Hydrogen, a lot of people think it's kind of a non-starter. So this is my personal point of view and does not reflect that of my colleagues in GLBRC necessarily. Where are we technologically? Well, we're currently in the fossil fuel era. Someday, maybe, we'll get to fusion, in which case we'd have unlimited amounts of electricity. And then if we also combine that with better batteries, all of our problems are solved. We can all run electric cars. Of course, then, you know, as you probably read about lithium, for example, for lithium for batteries, well, who owns the lithium, right? So maybe we're going to be back into another OPEC situation no matter what we do. There are all of these, I'm not going to go through all of these technical components of making alternative fuels. Right now, we're in the starch to enzymes to yeast fermentation to ethanol. So we're over here. And we're trying to work very hard just even to get to the next category here. Everything with an asterisk there is, so there's somebody in the GLBRC working on some part of that. Engineering plants to make them more digestible, better enzymes, new microbial ethanolagens, other things besides yeast that can make ethanol or other compounds, like even some strange molecules that have potential fuel use. Anyway, there's some people are working on thermochemical where you can convert lignocellulose directly to glucose, a potentially game-changing process if they can ever get it to work economically. Maybe I should have shown this earlier in order to describe exactly what we mean by lignocellulosic ethanol. This is what Brazil does. They convert sugar canes, ferment it straight to ethanol. Very efficient, especially if you have cheap labor, and a lot of I think the majority of the transportation fuels in Brazil are made by our ethanol now. What we do in the U.S. and other northern climates where we can grow a lot of corn is you have to convert the starch into corn with enzymes or some relatively simple. You get out pure glucose, which you feed to your yeast to make them, convert them into ethanol. Again, a technology that's thousands of years old. When we come to using lignocellulose, there are a couple of much more serious technological hurdles. Cellulosic biomass basically stems and stalks of a plant. We have to take these things, which are made out of cell walls. It's very tough lignocellulosic material. Typically, you have to grind it down to some reasonable size. You have to transport it, not a trivial factor. Then some sort of pretreatment, typically high temperature pressures with acids or bases or other chemicals to soften it up. And then we dump on enzymes that take apart these polymers of material and convert them into free sugars, which can then be fermented. Now, unlike starch, we don't get just glucose out. We get mixed sugars because plant cell walls are highly complex. They do have a lot of glucose in them. Cellulose, just like starch, is pure glucose. But there are a lot of other sugars, too. And so you have to try to ferment these as well, which is a technical challenge. Yeah, as I just said, starch is pure glucose. It's linked differently. And that makes all the difference in terms of how easy it is to take apart. Because cellulose composed of these chains of glucose can pack together in a crystalline form. And crystals are just very hard to take apart. And all of the other stuff in there, besides the cellulose, which is about 35% of a corn stem, there's a lot of stuff called hemicellulose. This is polysaccharides of sugars, very complex, very diverse, and differ from plant to plant and cell type to cell type. They do have glucose, but they have all these other sugars in there too, which are all, they're all sugars, but yeast likes glucose, and it doesn't like these other sugars very much. And then there's all the glue holding this stuff together called lignin. That's what makes wood brown, is the lignin. That's about 30% in trees at least. And it's a very tough glue-like substance that makes it very hard to deconstruct or take apart cell walls. And then a lot of other ingredients too, which are either potential secondary markets. So people say, well, if you could get the organic acids, there's a market for ferulic acid. You could sell that and make your plant more profitable. This gets into the whole scale-up economics of industrial processes that is beyond my knowledge. Another way to look at plant cell walls is simply consider a bale of straw. That's pure lignocellulose. And if we had a great process worked out, you could convert that into ethanol efficiently and economically. This is a cross-section of a plant stem, corn, I believe, yeah. And basically all you're seeing here are cell walls. These cells would have been alive at one time. But these cells, even in the living intact plant, are dead. What these cells do is they make an extremely thick cell wall and then they die. They have purely a structural function. They hold the stem upright. And these are transport cells for transporting water and nutrients around in the plant. The cell wall structure of this is different than these cells and different than these cells, which creates a lot of heterogeneity, which is a technical challenge. But you can see that in plants, the cell wall is really a defining feature. It's safe to say that a plant is mainly composed of cell walls. All right, a couple of words about what we might... The starting point is what plant are you going to use to make biofuels, lignocellulosic biofuels. And there are a lot of alternatives. Some people like plain old corn stover. Among other things, we're already producing millions of tons of it every year, and we grow corn. But some people think that we could do better with dedicated energy crops, like, in this case, switchgrass. Grows well in Michigan. It has very, very high yields. It's a perennial, which is interesting, unlike corn. You grow it, after 3 or 4 years, you can start to harvest it at the end of the year. At the end of the year, it sucks the nutrients out of leaves back into the roots to provide nutrients for the next season. So you don't have to fertilize anywhere near as much as you do with corn. The disadvantage is if a farmer has to wait 3 or 4 years to get a crop. And none of these crops, other than corn, have been grown to any significant extent for a very long period of time. Well, I guess that's not true for sorghum, but we're thinking of special varieties of sorghum. So we don't know how they're going to do agronomically. But people in pilot projects have shown that you get very high yields. Miscanthus is a popular one, a very fast-growing tropical one. Yeah, I think it's kind of more suited to southern areas. I try to grow it in my garden, and it died. There are horticultural varieties of miscanthus, though, that people grow. Now, another potential source that I'm interested in my own lab is this stuff called DDG. This is the dry distiller's grains. This is what's left over after a typical fermentation process. If you're making whiskey or making industrial ethanol from cornstarch, about a third of the seed is left over when you're done. Only about two-thirds of that material is, and these ethanol plants are generating huge quantities of this stuff. And they really don't know what to do with it. If you dry it, which takes a lot of energy, you can ship it and use it as animal feed. But if you don't dry it, it rots in about a week. We think there might be some potential here. For one thing, it's already being made. It's basically a byproduct of existing technologies. Now, the people in Area 4, sustainability, Thrust 4, Area 4, the sustainability people are thinking even more outside the box. They're not just thinking of monocultures like miscanthus or switchgrass. They're thinking, why not use more complex populations like native grasses or old fields, abandoned fields full of weeds, or even restored prairie, depending on where you are in the country. You could imagine prairies are extremely productive. You could mow them several times a year. There are a lot of environmental advantages to growing mixed populations. You get much more diversity of insects and animals. And so there are a lot of advantages, and it could be. In fact, that would also be cheaper, right? You wouldn't have to fertilize them. They are self-seeding. And so economically, it might make a lot of sense to use these kinds of things. One of my favorite plants would be this one, goldenrod. In my lab, we work on pretreatment enzyme combinations, and I went to Phil Roberts and I said, we want to work, if old fields and prairies are going to be our source of biomass, give me a typical plant that might be characteristic of these that I could work with. And he suggested goldenrod. And you can see why. Here's an abandoned field. This picture is taken about 20 miles from here by my graduate student who lives out in the country. And this is pure goldenrod, a pretty noxious weed. It just grows everywhere. Very low input plant, right? No fertilizer necessary. No matter what you do, it'll grow. So why not come through and just mow that down and take it to your ethanol plant? And could we efficiently convert this into ethanol? I don't know. I can imagine a vision someday that people with goldenrod will become a valuable agronomic plant. We'll have breeders working on better varieties of it. Hard to believe, but maybe someday. So here's the lignocellulose pipeline as currently envisioned. You start out with your material, and as I just said, there are a lot of options for what you might use for that. And then most people consider you need some sort of pretreatment, a softening up process to get those crystals pulled apart and the lignin removed or modified. There are a lot of candidates for good pretreatments. AFEX is a process using ammonia that was invented by Bruce Dale here at Michigan State. So a lot of us in the GLBRC are working on AFEX-treated material. But there's also acid. You can just use steam. In my lab, we're doing some work on alkaline peroxide, a fairly benign but not yet economical way to break open the lignocellulose. This is the main focus of my work, is on the enzymes. People think that there are no thermochemical, that is, no chemical processes that will efficiently convert lignocellulose to free sugars. But we do it with enzymes, and these enzymes come from microorganisms that have evolved to grow on lignocellulosic materials. And then you get a fermentation step. There's a lot of alternatives here. Yeast is the original one, but we can genetically engineer yeast to do other tricks and be better. There are a lot of other microbes, including our old workhorse E. coli, that can be genetically modified to do just about anything, it seems like. They understand it so well. They've taken it apart and reassembled it so many different ways. But other more exotic bugs that some people think have advantages and disadvantages, and then eventually if you make ethanol, you have to distill it, and then you end up with your liquid fuel. But it isn't necessarily ethanol. Some people think butanol is better. Some people think other more exotic molecules. All right, so finally I want to say a few words about what I do in my own research when I'm not signing travel authorizations. We want to make better enzymes. Okay, so in this procedure here, Well, you can use enzymes. You can show that it works, but it's just way too expensive still. The enzymes cost a lot. We can't make enzymes in a test tube or a factory. You have to have living things make enzymes, which are complex proteins. And so that's just intrinsically expensive. So we want to make better cocktails of enzymes. As I'm going to describe, it takes many different enzymes to break down the lignocellulose because it's so complex. Starch is easy. It takes a single enzyme, amylase, to break down starch to glucose, but cell walls are way different. So what we have to work with right now are so-called cellulases, enzymes that break down cellulose, but they're complex and poorly defined, and we're trying to make ones that do the job better. Just to break down cellulose, never mind all the other components in the cell wall, it takes at least three enzymes. And this cartoon shows that from this fungus called Trichoderma ricei, this is a fungus that's adapted to grow on lignocellulosic materials. Lignocellulose is widespread in the environment. There's billions of tons of it made every year by plants, and it's all broken down every year. It doesn't build up by microbes, fungi, and bacteria. Just to take apart, and this yellow is supposed to show crystalline cellulose. Each yellow dot is a molecule of glucose. They're held together in long chains, and then these chains are packed together very tightly. And it takes at least three enzymes, actually four shown here, just to pull apart this one molecule. One enzyme comes along and makes a cut in the chain. Another molecule, two of them actually, CBH1 and CBH2, nibble back along those chains, starting at the cuts made by this one. And what it releases is cellobiose, which is a dimer of glucose. It's two glucose molecules stuck together. So yeast can't ferment that, so you need another enzyme called beta-glucosidase that then cuts these dimers into single glucose molecules. So these single yellow dots, that would be what you could feed to yeast. This is just for the cellulose, and then, then you get into the hemiceluloses, all the other components. So about a third of the cell wall, and I don't think you can ignore those. You can't afford to throw away that much of the cell wall. But you can see right away in terms of the numbers of sugars and the kinds of linkages, they're very complex. In fact, we don't even understand the structures of all of these molecules. And we especially don't know how they're all put together. Amazing amount we don't know about plant cell walls still. But to give you one example, here's a hemicellulose called xyloglucan. Just like cellulose, it has a backbone of beta-1,4-linked glucose. Never mind the details, but it's got all these decorations on it. It's got xylose coming off. It's got galactose. It has fucose. And this glucuronorabinoxylan, or GAX, you've got a lot of arabinose and these glucuronic acid, and these are modified. So every single kind of bond in here needs a different enzyme to cut it. So to process this one all the way to free glucose and xylose, you have to cut there, 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 there. So that's four enzymes just for that one. It gets even more complicated because certain enzymes like to cut here only if there's a xylose here or not. And these enzymes are very specific and sometimes frustratingly hard to understand what they're doing. I was going to say, this is a technique we use to separate proteins from each other. And if you take these commercial cellulase preps, come from like companies like Novozymes or Spezyme, OptiMash, they have these creative names. Each blob you see there is a separate protein. So when you run out these mixtures, you can see 50 or even 100 different proteins. Each band is a separate protein doing something to cell walls. We often don't know what. But we know, for example, this big blob here is CBH1. That's probably endogluconase. But these mixtures are very complex. And the driving force for my own research is that we can't work with these complex, undefined mixtures. We have to understand the details before we can hope to get anywhere. And so we're making synthetic mixtures of enzymes. We take the individual genes for all of those proteins. We use those genes to make large quantities of individual pure proteins, and then we mix them together in defined ways where we know exactly what components are in there and in what proportions. This is the whole rationale. The bottom line is that we hope, or our goal is, once we've made synthetic mixtures that are optimized, we can optimize them for different substrates and different pretreatment substrate combinations. So you might need one cocktail for goldenrod and one cocktail for miscanthus, one cocktail for corn stover, another one, and if it's aphex or alkaline phosphide pretreatments. So we're going to get to custom enzyme cocktails. That's very much in the future, but that's sort of a vision. Even you could even imagine blending your own custom enzyme cocktails at the ethanol plant as the biomass comes in. So we've designed this platform, as we call it. We call it GenPlat to give it a snazzy name. We make individual pure proteins. This is still a huge bottleneck. You can clone genes really easily. And a lot of people are out there busy cloning genes. And people are very proud when they identify 100 new cellulase genes from some new microbe. And my response is, well, the genes is the easy part. We've got these DNA sequencers. They all generated sequences forever and ever. But the genes don't do anything. People often forget that. The genes themselves don't do anything. It's the proteins, the products. The genes encode the proteins, and it's the proteins that actually do the job, do the work. So you have to make those, and that is still, you have to do that in a living system, and it's quite a bottleneck. We use some fancy statistical design of experiment, and then we have a robotic pipetting of corn, stover, slurry, and the enzymes to make all sorts of possible combinations. A typical experiment, we'll do this in these 96 well plates, which I'll show you on the next slide. We seal them, incubate them for 48 hours, let the enzymes work, and then we sample what comes off, and we have automated ways of sampling glucose and xylose release. Those are the two main sugars, so those are the ones we're interested in. So we have this snazzy robot. If you ever come over to Plant Biology Building, I'd be glad to show it to you. It's in the basement. It costs $200,000. We couldn't have gotten it except for the GLBRC. So here is our little chamber that keeps the corn slurry suspended. And then this arm comes along with pipette tips, disposable pipette tips, and it picks up enzymes from here and transfers them into this 96-well plate here. This is a block of plastic kind of deep. In the bottom, there's some corn stover that's already been pipetted in. And we have to test, say, combinations of 11 enzymes and all possible combinations. So there are thousands of pipetting steps. Some of these whales get 11 different enzymes added to them. And so it'd be something impossible to do by hand. These are just boxes of empty tips. And this arm, let's see if I can get this movie to run. So here comes the tip, and it's picking up a sample. There's eight arms there. It's going to pick up eight different things out of this. Here's the corn slurry going around and around, staying suspended. It's insoluble, right? So it's little particles that are. And then it comes over and it dispenses into these wells exactly what it is that's specified by the program in the right proportions. And it does this all and gets rid of those old tips, picks up a new set of tips, and then it goes back and picks up and it takes about an hour to distribute all the enzymes into this little well, into these plates, and then we can just seal that plate and do the experiment. So we've done some pretty massive experiments. So, for example, well, this is the layout. This is the flow chart for one experiment. We started with a set of six enzymes. This is called our core set, and then we added tested sequentially enzymes. Some made a difference, some didn't. If they did make a difference, we went on. If they didn't make a difference, we tossed them out or set them aside. They might make a difference for one substrate, but not another. A lot of these proteins, like CYP1 and CYP2, we know that this fungus makes them when you grow it on cellulose, and it makes a lot of them, but we have no idea what they do. We have no understanding of their enzymatic function. Maybe they don't do anything, but so at the end of the day, what do we end up with? And we put it through this statistical package. We end up with a figure like this that shows us that if we want to maximize glucose yield from this particular, we need this proportion of all of these enzymes. Some enzymes made no difference, at least for glucose. Others, like the cellobiohydrolase that act on cellulose, is, as we expected, a very important enzyme. We're intrigued by cell 61. That's just an arbitrary designation, cell 61A. We don't have no idea what it does. But what these experiments tell us is that it's a very important enzyme. You better have 17% of it in there if you want to get maximum glucose yield. This is an optimization experiment. So we set this at a fixed total protein loading. That means that if you increase CBH1, something else has to go down. So these enzymes are almost like competing with each other. And what we end up with then is an optimal proportion. So we're designing a synthetic mixture. And these proportions are very different than what the fungus naturally makes. Some enzymes didn't make any difference at all. And each of these enzymes makes a special cut. Arabinosidase cuts the arabinose off the xyloglucan, et cetera. We've only just started on this. This only has 11 components in it, but we're working away. We're getting enzymes from many different sources. Any enzyme we get, we can test it. It either makes a difference or it doesn't. You can also optimize this procedure for xylose release. So xylose is the second most common sugar in cell walls. And when you run the same data through the package and tell it to optimize for xylose, you come up with a very different solution. Now, other enzymes like endoxylanases are even more important. And some of these accessory enzymes that nibble sugars off of the xylose become more important for logical reasons. What we're always trying to do here is we're trying to benchmark against a commercial enzyme. There's one called Accelerase 1000 made by Genencor. It's a very potent mixture, very concentrated. And under these identical conditions, it gives us about 50% glucose yield. 50% of the glucose gets released. And so far, our 11-component mixture does about as well as that. So on the one hand, we're happy because we're doing it with a defined, much less complex mixture, but we're going to have to do about 10 times better than Accelerase before we're going to be economic. And so it's all very dependent on the pretreatment. We've been doing work on pretreatments, too. I mentioned AFEX is a method developed by Bruce Dale. We in our lab have discovered that alkaline peroxide pretreatment is working well. One of the advantages of it is we can do it at regular room atmospheric pressure. That means no high pressure, special reaction chambers. And we can do it at room temperature. We don't have to heat it, which requires energy. It happens fairly fast, uses normal household ingredients. You would never use these because they'd be much too expensive. Hydrogen peroxide, sodium hydroxide, which is the main ingredient in Drano, and a bucket. And it's scalable. So that means you can increase the volume. All you need is a bigger bucket, as I tell my colleagues. And this annoys them no end because a lot of other methods out there, including, I should say, AFEX, but also ionic liquids, they're very high-tech, very fancy, but they almost all require either very expensive reagents or very special reaction chambers. But we like this because we can do it in our own lab. What?
You can do it in the bathtub.
Bathtub, yeah. You could. It's a new concept in bathtub gin, right? Hasn't escaped our attention that ethanol has multiple functions, multiple uses. At the end of the reaction, you neutralize it, you add your enzymes and go. And then what comes out of that, what we're hoping to do is be able to dump yeast in there and convert it to ethanol. We want to make a process that's as simple as possible, and we can do it all in the same bucket. Anyway, there's some pros and cons of this method. The main problem still is hydrogen peroxide is too expensive. So one of the things we're trying to do is get the same utility or the same kind of digestibility with less. This shows kind of the current status of where we are. At a loading, as we say, of hydrogen peroxide of 0.5 grams per gram of biomass, we can get 95% of the sugar out with a reasonable enzyme loading. This is still not economical, I don't think. For one thing, the peroxide's too expensive. You notice we can drop it in half, and it's almost as good in terms of glucose yields. If we go lower, we can recycle the peroxide. We can stabilize it in various ways. We think there are still things to try to make this better. And we're currently working an enzyme loading of 15 milligrams of protein per gram of glucan, and that is still uneconomical. Overall goal is to drive this curve to the left till we get down to maybe, if we could get to one, I think we would have a process that would be clearly economically possible, but we're not there yet. The way we're hoping to get there, sorry, that's in my last slide, I guess. The way we're hoping to get there is by exploring additional enzymes. We have strong reason to think that there are a whole lot of additional enzymes, and when we add them, will allow us to get the same amount or more glucose for less protein loading. Okay, so that gives you, I hope, a little flavor of the kind of work we're doing and why we're doing it, more importantly. Thanks for your attention.
So is the center actually located here on campus in like a little office space, or
yeah.
Is it a facility?
Yeah, most of the administrative stuff goes on at Wisconsin because they're a lead institution. Technically, we have a subcontract from Wisconsin. And we have an office over in food safety and toxicology. Currently, 4 people work there. We also have information technology support and some other support facilities. In the basement of plant biology, we have a GLBRC-wide facility that's got 2 components. One is an analytical platform. One of the things that everybody in the center, a lot of people in the center, do a lot of is cell wall composition. A new miscanthus, a new putrid, we want to know how much glucose is in there, how much xylose. You know, for example, the glucose yield, I have to know what 100% is, right? So we have a facility there that processes samples for everybody in the center. They also have a high-throughput robotics facility that can grind and dispense small amounts of plant material so we can compare plants against each other. So say you have 50 switchgrass varieties. You want to know which one has got the best potential. We can do that in a high-throughput way. So that's all in the basement of plant biology. That's where this my robot is, too. So that's what we've got on campus. Oh, hi.
Well, thanks, John. It's really interesting. Totally naive question. As you're looking for new enzymes, have you looked at enzymes from cow's ruminants?
Oh, a lot of people are, you bet. The cow is the ultimate biorefinery, in fact, right? It does everything that a biorefinery has to do. It grinds it up, and then it ferments it. And the microbial ecology of the cow rumen is really fascinating. There are dozens and dozens of microbes, and they're all working together. They're not, some of them are competing, but a lot of them are working together. Like one will convert one molecule into another and get some energy out of it, and then that serves as the food for the next microbe. And a lot of people are trying to reproduce the cow rumen. Can we make it industrial? Though that's, when you're dealing with microbial ecology and all, you're dealing with an entire ecosystem, so the complexity is pretty overwhelming, how many things are going on at once.
This is another really naive question, but Henry Ford designed the first cars to be run on corn liquor grown on the farm.
Yeah.
Hasn't anybody, gone back to that original research of, why doesn't everybody grow their own little corn plants to fuel their own cars?
They could. Henry Ford back in the 20s was very enthusiastic about ethanol, and there were gas stations that sold ethanol, and as he pointed out, you can make it from any agricultural crop residue. I guess the bottom line is that petroleum is so much cheaper. That's the problem. I mean, gas at $2.80 a gallon is a remarkable bargain. May not. And I say half seriously to people when they ask me, oh, is your research going to lower the cost of gasoline? I say, no, but when gasoline reaches $10 a gallon, we'll have an alternative, homegrown alternative. But not yet. I don't think there's any way you can make ethanol cheaper than gasoline currently. Maybe equal, but so that's what happened. It's like a steam-powered cars got beaten out by gasoline, too. Gasoline was just so plentiful and cheap.
Just because of transportation.
Hmm?
Just need better transportation.
Better public transportation, maybe?
Just anything better than the standard car. Engine.
Standard automobile, yeah. It's a real luxury. I think we'll look back on it. The idea that everybody can have their own car and drive to work by themselves and you don't have to wait even 5 minutes on the street corner. And yeah, it's great, you know, but I'm hoping we also look back at that this work is visionary, that Congress, that DOE had a vision before it was needed, right, that we were working on it. We saw the problem coming, and we didn't just stick our heads in the sand and pretend that things weren't going to get worse. We'll see. I mean, you know, work on ethanol and lignocellulosics had a heyday also in the 70s when there was the gas crunch and there was a burst of research then the funding dried up. So places like the National Renewable Energy Lab in Colorado have seen boom and bust. They've seen it go up and down in the past, and they fear that it might happen again, that people will get distracted and won't be an issue again.